recent student suicides have prompted intense counseling efforts in the Butte School District. Good evening, I'm Connor Ballantyne, and that's our top story tonight on Montana Evening Edition. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce tells us how a new state water plan could change how the legislature views climate change. And in our feature interview, news director Sally Mock talks with the state's top disaster official about the danger of rail tanker cars carrying Bakken oil exploding. Several grief counselors have been brought into the Butte School District this week to help students and staff deal with the loss of three high school students in the last 6 weeks, two to suicide and one whose death is still being investigated, according to District Superintendent Judy Jonart. Jonart says the district is heartbroken over the deaths and has activated its crisis response team.
Calling trees are set up, and counselors and mental health workers then go on site, and we provide individual counseling for students on an as-needs basis.
Jonart says the counseling will continue to be available through this week. There will also be a suicide prevention informational meeting for parents at 7 p.m. January 22nd in the Butte High School auditorium.
And we elicited the help from the State Department of Health and Human Services, and Carl Rawson will be in our community on January 21st, and then again on the 22nd. We will be doing a review basically for our staff, and then after the 7 o'clock parent meeting will be available, and he is the leading expert in these situations, and then provide that opportunity for parents to come in and ask questions.
School officials hope any concerned parents will contact them for assistance, and Jonart says some already have.
We have encouraged parents to call, and that was one of our big messages. We have encouraged parents to call our counselor's office if they did indeed have any concerns about their individual child, and then we would do follow-up. So that is, we've had parents call and do that, and we're very, very appreciative, and that's just an additional support for our kids.
Jonart says the district has also been getting calls of support and offers of help from around the state. And in other news, the Ravalli County Sheriff's Office is investigating what appears to be a murder-suicide in a residence northwest of Darby. Deputies responded to the residence at about noon yesterday after receiving a report of a person who appeared to have been shot to death. Deputies found two people dead at the house. Sheriff Chris Hoffman says the case is still under investigation, and his office will release more information once the victims have been identified and their families notified. A 40-year-old Great Falls man is charged with raping an 8-year-old girl, while the girl's mother faces an endangerment charge for allowing the man to continue to live at their house. Anthony Joseph Du Bois was arrested last Friday and made an initial district court appearance yesterday on a charge of felony sexual intercourse without consent. The girl told investigators that Du Bois assaulted her in November. The girl's mother is charged with criminal child endangerment. Cascade County prosecutors say she told the girl not to report the assault. The Associated Press is withholding the name of the mother to avoid identifying the girl. The woman also made an initial appearance. Neither have entered pleas, and both remain jailed today. The assault was reported while the girl was staying with an out-of-town relative. A Montana judge says his decision to retire at the end of the year is unrelated to widespread condemnation for his comments that a 14-year-old rape victim appeared, quote, older than her chronological age, end quote. District Judge Todd Baugh told the Associated Press that his time on the bench has been rewarding, and he looks forward to spending more time with his 5 grandchildren. The judge has repeatedly apologized for his remarks in the case of Stacey Rambold. He also made an unsuccessful attempt to resentence the former teacher after prosecutors said the short prison term given to Rambold violated state law. Advocates have waged a campaign to have the State Judicial Standards Commission remove him from the bench. A spokeswoman for the Montana chapter of the National Organization for Women says their efforts will continue. Human-caused climate change remains a politically divisive topic in Montana, especially in the state legislature. A Democratic state representative hopes a new water plan being developed by the Montana Department of Natural Resources and Conservation results in more climate science making its way into state policy. Capitol reporter Dan Boyce has the story.
So what we have in Montana, as mentioned, is a system that's defined by things like the Pacific Decadal Oscillation, the Arctic Oscillation, El Niño.
Montana State University Assistant Professor Paul Stoy is talking to a group of lawmakers about the key stresses faced by the state's water sources. That group of lawmakers is the state's Water Policy Interim Committee. And they're hearing from a couple of climate scientists about issues like the changing of Montana's mountain snowpack and the projections of future water supplies. Livingston Democratic Representative Riley Neal put forth the study which brought these scientists before the committee.
The climate variability in the state of Montana is real. It's happening. The people on the ground, the ranchers and the farmers, they know this.
Neal says it's really hard to talk about climate change in the state legislature. Bills acknowledging it have been quickly dismissed by Republican majorities in past legislative sessions. But she says both parties do focus on water.
Stream flow numbers, we're trusting that. Snowpack numbers, we're going to trust all that science.
We all recognize that water is the key universal ingredient to economic health, vitality, quality of life for Montana.
That's Hamilton Republican Representative Pat Cannell. He's also on the Water Policy Interim Committee and says the state is clearly dealing with shorter winters.
To ignore that as a risk to our water resource is at our own peril.
Cannell is not willing to go so far as to say humans are causing the changes Montana's climate is experiencing, but he says it's very useful to have that information as part of the discussion. And it likely will be. The Department of Natural Resources and Conservation is updating the state's water plan for the first time in about 20 years. The water plan will give policy recommendations to the legislature. And DNRC officials say this plan will include all kinds of research on the impacts of climate change on water resources, research that didn't exist 20 years ago. Representative Riley Neal describes that as a kind of backdoor way for climate research to become a more serious part of the policy discussion, in the sense that the discussion would focus first and foremost on protecting the state's water.
It gives me a lot of hope for the future of the state, not just the state water plan, but also, you know, perhaps a relaxing of the politics of global warming or climate change so that we can actually get some work done.
A draft of the DNRC's updated state water plan should be finished sometime this summer. I'm Dan Boyce reporting at the Capitol.
Snowpack levels in Montana this winter, on the whole, are better than at this time last year. Natural Resources Conservation Service water supply specialist Brian DeMoncos says as of yesterday, the state's snowpack stood at 105% of average compared to 91% of average at this same time last year.
So in the Columbia, on the west side of the divide in Montana, we're looking at about 96% of average. And then on the east side of the divide here, we're looking at 111% of average. That includes the Yellowstone and the Missouri. The St. Mary's is just below average at 99% of average. The Milk is about 200% of average, but you've got to keep in mind that that is typically a very low snowpack, so just a little bit of snow can make a big difference there in terms of percents of average.
DeMoncos notes Montana's almost halfway through its snowpack accumulation season. A slight lull in precipitation is common during January and February, with wetter conditions not unusual for March through May. NRCS expects to present Montana's streamflow forecast sometime in the next week. Authorities have identified an Oregon State Police trooper who struck a Montana robbery suspect with a patrol car as officers tried to arrest the man and a woman on the Oregon coast. State Police Lieutenant Greg Hastings says Trooper Adam Cowing struck 30-year-old Dale Wallace with a patrol car when Wallace pointed a gun at officers last Friday in Lincoln City after being told to drop the weapon. Cowing is on paid leave while the case is investigated. He's a member of the State Police SWAT team. Wallace remains in serious condition in a Portland-area hospital. He's in custody on felony warrants issued in a December 30th coin shop robbery in Butte. Wallace's companion, 30-year-old Sarah Jo Johnson, fatally shot herself in a vehicle last Friday night in Lincoln City after a several-hour standoff with law enforcement officers. An autopsy yesterday by the Oregon State Medical Examiner's Office confirmed she died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound. Hastings says there's no indication that any officers fired during the standoff. Newport police are leading a multi-agency investigation in the case. Some conservation groups are suing federal and state officials over Idaho's plan to track and kill wolves from two packs in central Idaho. The lawsuit, filed yesterday by Defenders of Wildlife, Western Watersheds Project, and Wilderness Watch, asks the judge to stop the extermination immediately to give the case time to work through the courts. Idaho wildlife officials hired the hunter late last year to begin killing the two packs in the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. The Idaho Department of Fish and Game hopes the extermination will aid the recovery of elk populations in the region. The conservation groups contend the large-scale removal of wolves contravenes federal law and alters the character of the Frank Church River of No Return Wilderness. Overcrowded classrooms, outdated technology, new construction, old buildings, new curriculum, and online venues for the enduring issue of bullying are among the issues facing many school districts in 2014. Growth and change at the Kalispell School District 5 has been visible over the past 10 years with the creation and construction of a second high school. The woman at the reins during these changes is District 5 Superintendent Darlene Schottel, who is retiring at the end of the school year. Schottel talks with Flathead reporter Katrin Fry about the physical and conceptual changes the district has undergone over the past 10 years and the changes on the horizon.
Superintendent Darlene Schottel came on board in Kalispell in July of 2003. District 5 looked a little different then.
There were five elementary schools, but they were K-6 buildings. And then we had a seventh grade center. Then we had a junior high that had grades 8 and 9, and we had one high school with 10, 11, and 12.
Now the in-town elementary schools are K through 5. The junior high is now a middle school with 6th, 7th, and 8th grades. Schottel says one of the reasons for the change was to cut down on the number of transitions students had to make. In particular, many of the rural schools go up to 8th grade, and then students would matriculate into Kalispell.
About half of our students were coming to, at that point, the junior high for 1 year and then moving on to the 10, 11, 12 high school. And it was kind of a shock to have all of a sudden 600 students put together, and for some of our students that came from small schools that might only have 8 or 9 or 10 kids in a classroom.
Also, Flathead High School went from among the biggest schools in the state to 2 9-12 high schools, Flathead and Glacier. Schottel says all these changes represented programmatic changes as well as responses to space concerns and major community investments to renovate Flathead High, the middle school, and build Glacier High. Schottel's tenure has also spanned the boom years of the early 2000s and the recession the area is still climbing out of, where the district has been hard-pressed to pass building levies to cover things like technology.
It looks to be a positive improvement in the economy that we will be able to move back to those regular operational kind of levies or technology bonds so that we can provide access. That instructional component for technology and for student access is a very important piece and one that we're concerned about that we will need to continue to find a way to address in some manner.
Cyberbullying is an issue that didn't have much of a name 10 years ago, but has emerged as a pressing concern.
Throughout my career, we've always worked on what do you do about bullying and the programs at the school sites, but the media component of it has changed significantly just because it is so available. And even at a young age, our children have access to so much media, whether that be at home or on their phone or on the internet.
Schottel says the role of schools is giving students the skills to make the right choices to protect themselves and to not engage in hurtful online behavior. She says strategies from the educator's end continue to evolve.
It has to be a community, parental, school joint effort because it's not something we can just manage at school because quite often some of the incidents that happen, whether that we call it cyberbullying or whether somebody is being harassed or mean things said about them on a website, that doesn't always happen at school. It happens, can happen at any time of the day or night, unfortunately, but it certainly carries over.
Those internet savvy skills also have grown in importance for schoolwork.
20 years ago, we never would have thought about providing technology expertise and proficiency. We were much more concerned about students being able to have a knowledge base, a group of facts that they can draw upon, where in reality now that is not what we need them to have because, quite frankly, you can find facts.
Schottle says interpreting those facts is what students need to be able to do now, whether they're true, appropriate, and how they figure into the bigger picture. She says probably the biggest change she's seen, and that is ongoing, is curriculum expectations. Technologically, how information is consumed, and how teachers approach their topics. District 5 recently passed a bond and built new classroom space to deal with overcrowding at the elementary school level. Schottle says Flathead High School is an old building and has had some work done, but needs more. Building new space and maintaining old buildings will continue to be an issue for the next superintendent, as will the question of the role of technology in school and education and implementing the Common Core curriculum. In 2008, Schottle was a candidate for the superintendent position for Spokane Public Schools and was a finalist for the superintendent position for Eugene 4J School District in 2011. She says most superintendents last between 3 and 5 years in one place.
I think that I have been really fortunate to have had a good working relationship with our staff, community, and board for a longer period than that. And there's a lot of changes that are happening right now. And I feel that it's the right time to transition the leadership reins, that whoever is making some of these changes right now in Kalispell that will move forward with teachers, they need to have the longevity to do that for at least 3 to 5 years.
Schottle says right now she has no plans after retiring this spring other than to enjoy a summer off, but consulting might be something in her future. She retires at the end of this school year. Katrin Fry reporting from the Flathead.
The U.S. coal mining industry is projected to see a modest and short-lived rebound in 2014, driven by more production in western states after two successive years of declines. Today, the Energy Information Administration forecast a 36 million ton increase in coal production for the year to 1.04 billion tons. That's a 3.6% increase. Mining output is projected to fall by more than 25 million tons in 2015. Agency analyst Elias Johnson says that's because new rules for mercury pollution will kick in, prompting utilities to shutter some coal-burning power plants rather than make costly upgrades. The impacts on mining are expected to be most acute in areas such as the Powder River Basin of Wyoming and Montana, which produces more than 40% of U.S. coal. Montana's only breast milk bank has been screening, pasteurizing, and distributing human donor milk since early October of last year, and its executive co-director, Jessica Wellborn, says outreach efforts and interest is growing. The Mother's Milk Bank of Montana is the first regional milk bank to serve neonatal intensive care units and individual recipients in Montana, Idaho, North Dakota, South Dakota, and Wyoming. Wellborn says the human donor milk is offered to infants with medical needs who, for any of a variety of reasons, don't have access to their own mother's milk. For example, she says high-quality formula is great stuff, but just can't replicate what breast milk provides.
I mean, formula has all kinds of good things in it, you know, all kinds of vitamins and really essential things for a baby, but there are just certain things, and I think especially when it comes to the antibodies and the enzymes that help fight illness and keep a baby, you know, really healthy through those first couple of years of life, that just can't be found in any other milk, and it's species-specific, you know, the goat's milk or cow's milk is never going to have the same properties and benefits that human breast milk is going to have for a human baby.
For more information, visit mothersmilkbankofmt.org. We'll have more on the Mother's Milk Bank of Montana later this week on Montana Evening Edition. The boom in oil development in this country has increased the amount of oil shipped by rail from 10,000 tanker cars annually to 400,000 cars just in the last 4 years. As we reported last week, the Federal Department of Transportation has issued an alert warning that crude oil shipped from the Bakken oil fields may be more prone to catching fire than other kinds of oil. Last year, 47 people in a small town in Quebec were killed when a train carrying Bakken oil derailed and caught fire. And just last week, another train derailed and its oil tanker cars exploded near Castleton, North Dakota. The derailment occurred just outside of town and no one was injured. These incidents have caught the attention of local, state, and federal officials charged with mitigating and managing disasters. Ed Tinsley is the division administrator for Montana's Disaster and Emergency Services Department. In this feature interview, he talks with News Director Sally Mock about the dangers posed by rail transport of Bakken oil, a transport he says occurs throughout Montana.
Going through towns, obviously a majority of Montana is, you know, is open type areas, but when it, you know, railroads do go through towns, they go through small towns, they go through large towns, population centers as well.
And Bakken oil is being distributed west coast, east coast, south coast, so it's going in all those directions.
It's being distributed all over the place.
What are the state's concerns about
Sally, what we do is, at the Montana DES, is we work with local communities and local emergency planning committees, local jurisdictions, including tribal, city, and county. We work with them to ensure that if they do have transportation-related issues, you know, with their community, for instance, the High Line's a good example, if you look at the whole High Line, that they have emergency response plans in place for all hazardous materials.
Have you gotten inquiries in the wake of the North Dakota explosion?
We've had a couple since then. I believe it happened on New Year's Eve, and we've already had a couple of communities saying, hey, you know, we've got trains coming through our community. We're not up to date on our training as we'd like to be. Is there some training we could get? Is there some people you could put us in touch with for our local emergency response planning committees?
And are you reassuring to them and saying, well, we can address this and we feel like we're prepared?
Absolutely. Whenever we get requests from local communities, local jurisdictions for training, we try to get to them as quickly as we can. There's also private rail carriers in Montana, like BNSF and Montana Rail Link, they have hazmat teams available for response to issues that may arise in their lines. And they also have what's called a TransCar training program that takes rail cars, mock-up rail cars, to local communities to teach first responders about rail car type incidents. So they, you know, for instance, let's say they would take an oil tanker to a community and say, here's what an oil tanker looks like, here's what could potentially happen if it goes off the rails, etc. So it just gives them, some local responders, some familiarity.
There has been a national report from the Federal Department of Transportation that oil transported from the Bakken is particularly volatile and particularly prone to flammability. Was that something you knew, or is that new information?
For me specifically, now keep in mind, I'm not an oil or petroleum engineer. That's something that was new to me. That's interesting news, and it's obviously something that's going to be incorporated into the training for these local communities. Immediate response to incidents in local communities, let's say that if there is an issue in one of these communities, is always going to be from a local jurisdiction, and obviously mainly the fire department, and then law enforcement would, you know, be there to support them. There's also 6 regional hazmat teams across the state that can provide some response, but also technical assistance to these local communities.
Watching the video of the North Dakota rail explosion and seeing what happened there, it seems like the only response is to just stay away, which is what they seem to have done in that case.
Right. And I guess it would depend on each incident as it happens. It may not be safe to send in personnel immediately, but if you can get people away from the incident and secure the area, you may lose some property, you may damage some rail cars, you may damage some infrastructure, but if you can save lives until it gets to a point where you can send people in, that makes sense. That totally makes sense.
Does what has happened in North Dakota and Quebec, where many people lost their lives, dozens, because of...
That was last year about the same time.
Right. Do those incidents raise concerns with you and other disaster and emergency folks in Montana that with these trains going through towns like Missoula, Helena, Bozeman, with loads of particularly flammable oil, there has been the suggestion that maybe towns should be avoided for these shipments. Do you have extra concern about that? And do you think that's at all a feasible notion, that maybe the routes of these trains should be changed?
You know, Sally, as the head of disaster emergency services for the state of Montana, my job is to ensure that local communities have resources to events that occur in their communities if they become overwhelmed. I'll leave that question for the political professionals to deal with. It's my job to worry about how do I help respond to these local communities in the event that one of these, you know, any kind of issue, whether it's flooding or a wildfire, or, you know, God forbid, some kind of train disaster.
But what if one of those policymakers came up to you and said, Mr. Tinsley, do you think we should reroute these trains for safety? What would you say?
You know, I would have to do is sit down with some professionals who have the knowledge base of transportation-related issues, of petroleum-related issues, or hazardous material-related issues, and get some advice from them before I, you know, would comment. It's not something that I'm just going to comment on off the cuff.
There was an official with an organization called the Association of Hazmat Shippers, I don't know if you're familiar with that association, who said that there has been a long-standing problem with tank cars being prone to rupture, and that there's been a proposal for a long time that those cars should be improved. Do you know anything about that?
I have not heard anything about that. I certainly would be willing to look into that, but I haven't heard anything about that.
In terms of what has happened last year and this year in terms of these explosions, have your department or local officials changed anything about your response to a potential accident like that in Montana?
You know, what we do, Sally, is whenever we get a request from a local community, and we do encourage local communities that have particularized issues like, for instance, rail traffic, maybe an interstate that has, you know, road traffic that is carrying some kind of hazardous material. We always work with those local communities to ensure that they're up to date on their training as much as we can. We have district reps that work out across the state that work with the local communities and help them identify those issues and those potential problems. So whenever we have any kind of issue, whether it's, you know, related to rail traffic, whether it's related to road traffic, whether it's related to wildfire or potential flooding concerns, we do work with those local communities.
I have been speaking with Ed Tinsley, who's the division administrator for the Montana Department of Disaster and Emergency Services. Ed, thank you.
Thank you, Sally. Have a good day.
Now for tonight's forecast. West of the Divide, there is currently a winter weather advisory in effect until 9 a.m. tomorrow for the Flathead and Mission Valleys, the Lower Clark Fork region, the Missoula and Bitterroot Valleys, and the Bitterroot and Sapphire Mountains. Tonight, snow is likely, and there's also a slight chance of light freezing rain. Lows should be in the 20s. Tomorrow, snow showers are likely with possible rain and freezing rain. Highs should be in the mid-30s to lower 40s. In central Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow and lows 10 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow should be mostly cloudy with a slight chance of snow through the day and highs 35 to 45 degrees. Wind gusts could reach up to 45 miles per hour in the afternoon. And in southwest Montana tonight, it should be mostly cloudy with a chance of snow. Expect lows 15 to 25 degrees. Tomorrow, expect mostly cloudy skies with a chance of snow through the day and highs 30 to 40 degrees. If you have a comment about today's newscast, you can send it via our webpage at mtpr.org or on Montana Public Radio's Facebook page. Montana Evening Edition is also archived on our website. I'm Connor Ballantyne. Thanks for listening, and please join Edward O'Brien tomorrow at 7, 8, and 8:30 for Montana Morning News.